Well, I mentioned last week about a National Press Club event in Canberra with Hugh White, a Professor of Strategic Studies at the ANU, whom we had on the program a couple of weeks back, if you remember, and Gareth Evans, the former ALP Foreign Minister and now Chancellor at the ANU. They were giving their very experienced opinions on US-China relations and on what role Australia could play in it. In that particular bridge building or life for the future. Two very experienced brains, one from a more diplomatic strand, the other defence, but both accustomed to government or working closely with it, but coming together to discuss the rising tension between these two dominant powers and their roles in the Asian region, our own region. And this discussion was made even more pertinent by comments this week by Colonel Tom Hansen, the Assistant Chief of Staff of the US Army and Director of US Pacific Command Action Group. He told Fran Kelly on RN's Breakfast this week.
I think the Australians need to make a choice. As Peter Jennings wrote in a recent op-ed piece, it's very difficult to walk this fine line between balancing the alliance with the United States and the economic engagement with China. At some point, there's going to have to be a decision of which one becomes more of a vital national interest for Australia.
Well, will it be a decision for us? Let's listen to how Hugh and Gareth see this situation with our edited version of that National Press Club talk.
I want to make four quick points. The first is that US-China relationship is getting worse. It's becoming characterised by strategic rivalry, and that rivalry is getting worse. The second point is that rivalry itself is very dangerous, more dangerous, I think, than we yet understand. The third point is that Australia is still in denial about the reality of that rivalry and how risky it can be for us, and we're not doing enough to effectively manage it. And the fourth is there are some things we can do. This is a very difficult challenge for us, but there are some things we can do to manage those issues better than we have. So the first point. The escalating strategic tension that we've seen between the US and China in the South China Sea is not about the South China Sea. It is a confrontation over their respective roles in Asia and the nature of their relationship with one another. For the last 40-odd years, China accepted America as the primary power in Asia, and that provided the foundation for a remarkably stable era. China no longer accepts that. America wants to remain Asia's primary power, and China wants to replace it as Asia's primary power. It's as simple as that. But we can't be surprised by it. And so this is a reality we're going to have to come to terms with. What's more, we're going to have to come to terms with the fact that this reality poses a very significant risk to Asia and to Australia. War between the United States and China is not inevitable. They can build a new relationship with one another without going through the tragedy of war to get there. But the risk is very real. Both sides, both the US and China, over the last few years increasingly, and even over the last few months, have sought by word and deed to signal their willingness to use force in the South China Sea. Now, let's be clear, neither side wants a conflict, but both believe they can get what they want without a conflict, because both believe the other side will back down. That is a very dangerous illusion. That is the illusion that pushed Europe to war in 1914. One of the reasons for that is that the stakes for both are very high. This is not just about who controls the rocks and reefs of the South China Sea. It's not even about freedom of navigation, though that's an important issue. It's about the status of each power in the world's most important and fastest growing region. It's about who plays the leading strategic role in that region. It's about, therefore, their identity, the way they see themselves as countries. And both are countries who see themselves as leaders in a way that's very deeply embedded in their national sense of themselves. And the consequence, of course, for Australia of that, well, almost unimaginable. That means the stakes for us are very high. Even if the risk of a conflict is just a few percent, and I think it could be higher than that, this constitutes one of the most serious risks Australia's faced in a very long time. And if it happens, no one will be able to look back at today and say, well, we didn't see that coming. No, no. What we're seeing today, the pattern of rivalry we've seen over the last few years and months, even weeks, is precisely what, from a study of history, you would expect to see in the lead-up to a major power conflict. So I'm not saying I'm sure one's coming. But if it does come, we'll say this is how wars start. And we in Australia, my third point, are in denial about this. We assume the United States will fix it. That's a big mistake, because the United States itself is in denial about the seriousness of this challenge. The heart of US approach to China is an assumption that the Chinese in the end will back off. And that's the idea that's underpinned the pivot, and that's why the pivot has failed, because China has not backed off. And we too in Australia also assume that China will back off. It's clear, for example, from the Defence White Paper published by this government a few months ago, that it believes in all its talk of the rules-based global order that somehow the Chinese will be persuaded to step back and accept US primacy as a foundation for the Asian order indefinitely. There is, in fact, no escaping the reality that China is going to play a much bigger strategic role in Asia than it has hitherto. The old US-led uncontested order in Asia has gone. We're going to have to learn to live with a different order and do whatever we can to try and shape it to our advantage. So that's the fourth point. What can we do? Well, here's a few suggestions. Let's agree that Australian political leaders should stop saying we don't have to choose between America and China, because it's not true. We're making choices all the time. We face pressure from America to align against China. We have done ever since Barack Obama's speech in Parliament in 2011. We face pressure from China not to align with America. We walk a fine line between those pressures, making choices all the time about how far we go one way or the other. You can see that in successive governments' manoeuvrings on the question as whether we should do freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. And that's because both the US and China now judge Australia as a strategic and political partner, primarily in terms of how close we appear to be aligned with the other. This is a zero-sum game which Australia is playing. The second thing we should do is to stop making it worse. The diplomatic ambiguity which Australian, some Australian policymakers pride themselves on, neither one side or the other, is more like duplicity and weakness. That is, we're telling the Americans or we're encouraging the Americans to believe that we will support them in a conflict with China, and we're encouraging the Chinese to believe that we won't. And that's encouraging both of them to be more assertive towards the other and making it more likely, not less likely, that we end up dealing with a catastrophic outcome. The third thing we should do is to recognise that there will be a new order in which China plays a bigger role, and that we cannot take for granted what kind of role the United States will play in that order, or even whether it will play a significant role at all. And I don't say that just because of a careful study of Donald Trump's foreign policy, but the broader trends which suggest that for America to continue to play a major strategic role in Asia, it is going to have to pay much higher costs and accept much higher risks than it has done hitherto, because it faces an adversary of China's power. And the fourth thing we should do is that if we want a substantial US role in Asia, and I think we should, and if we want that role to be so designed that it does not drive escalating strategic rivalry with China, and we should certainly want that, then we better help build that order, because that's not where we're heading at the moment. We should be looking for a way to help encourage the evolution of the regional order which suits our interests best, which is going to be one in which the United States plays the biggest possible role consistent with a stable relationship with Asia. That is not something which is going to happen easily. It's going to require Australia to do some very active and agile diplomacy. There's a scope for Australia to build a coalition in Asia of the other countries, the non-great powers, because we all want the same thing. None of us want to live under China's shadow. We all know that a strong US role in Asia is essential to avoid that. But none of us want escalating rivalry between the US and China. We all want them to get on. So we all want America to stay in Asia on the basis that China is willing to accept. And that is going to mean big compromises on both sides. We should be pushing for that. We shouldn't underestimate our capacity to do that. But we won't do that internationally until we've had a debate in Australia itself about this, until we've acknowledged the problems and worked out for ourselves what kind of solution we need. That is going to need real political leadership on these issues of a sort that we haven't seen so far.
Now, that was Professor Hugh White. Now, at the National Press Club, with our edited version, here are Gareth Evans' views.
Maybe it comes with the territory for those whose background is foreign affairs rather than defence. But I have to say that my view of the world in general, and more specifically of China's and the United States' relationship, relative place in Asia, and the prospects of that relationship ending in deadly conflict, my view is a little less apocalyptic than Hugh's. There is much that I do agree with, that said, in Hugh's analysis. One, the tectonic plates obviously have been shifting. China is manifestly no longer willing to continue to accept a situation where the United States is unchallenged rulemaker and enforcer, both economically and militarily. Two, it's not clear that everyone who matters in the United States has got that message. Although United States policymakers like Kurt Campbell argue very plausibly that the pivot is about broader engagement with Asia and cooperatively shaping a 21st century order in the region for everyone's benefit, it is the case still that much American public discourse sounds much more provocative, much more confronting to Chinese ears. We still hear too often publicly in the United States what I call the DLP words, maintaining the dominance, leadership, primacy, predominance of the United States in East Asia. I think the most confrontational recent articulation of this position is to be found in a Council on Foreign Relations paper published last year by Robert Blackwell and Ashley Tellis, who argue that the central objective should be, quote, preserving United States primacy in the global system. And they advocate a series of economic, political, and military measures which, although described as balancing China, unashamedly amount to containing it. But it's not just think tank fringe dwellers who use this kind of language. It needs to be remembered that President Obama said in his 2016 State of the Union address, with TPP, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, China doesn't set the rules in that region, we do. Third point I want to make in support of Jen's propositions articulated by Hugh is that if the United States-China relationship is not to end in very serious tears, it will be necessary for the United States to some extent accommodate to the reality of Chinese power and influence, to give it a little bit more strategic space in its own immediate region, and be much more careful about asserting institutional and rulemaking dominance in the kind of way that was so evident, not only the Trans-Pacific Partnership enterprise, which continues, but also it will be remembered with the AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. So all that said, on the other side of the coin, there are a number of respects in which I'm by no means on completely the same page as Hugh in terms of what he's not only said here today, but in his other writing. One, in this respect, I worry that some of Hugh's proposed cures for rebalancing the East Asian order in order to guarantee a more stable future may in fact be worse than the disease. In particular, I remain extremely alarmed about the insouciance with which Hugh seems to be prepared to contemplate a nuclear-armed Japan as part of a more evenly, militarily balanced new concert of powers in East Asia. Secondly, on the very vexed and immediately relevant question as to how much pushback there should be internationally against Chinese overreach. While understanding China's desire for more strategic space in its own region, a desire to avoid escalating strategic rivalry does not, to my mind, mean that there should be any kind of international acceptance of sovereignty or sovereignty-related claims that are manifestly ill-founded in international law. Third point I want to make to further develop that is that as unhappy as I remain, like you, with much US public discourse, I think it's important to acknowledge, as I know very well from direct personal experience, is that for the most part, private discourse by US policymakers is much more nuanced, much more sophisticated and balanced. And I'm prepared to believe that this is also characteristic of the many channels and forums for direct engagement that United States officials now do have with their Chinese counterparts. Add to that the reality of the United States and China being joined at the wallet in so many ways, the reality that more than 300,000 Chinese students are in the United States at any given time and 25,000 United States students studying in China, plus the huge flows, of course, of tourists and business people both ways. I think notwithstanding all these vexed strategic competition issues that are so fraught in so many ways, the overwhelming likelihood is that cooler heads will, in fact, prevail. So what, if any, role can Australia play in all of this to help ensure that cooler heads do prevail, or at least increase that likelihood? Well, I think it's fanciful to suggest that we, or anyone else for that matter, could play any kind of negotiating intermediary role. We should not underestimate the extent to which our voice is heard by both sides. It is the case that in both the United States and China, our voice as a very strong US ally gives us reason in both countries to be taken seriously and heard. Furthermore, our strength is that, as Hugh acknowledged, we do have a long, if periodically interrupted, record of being an active, creative, effective and diplomatic coalition-building middle power. And our capacity to build international coalitions, not least in Southeast Asia, doesn't go unnoticed by both the United States and China in these fraught environments. So I think we should use that voice with both sides in a way that calls the issues as we see them, without being over-apologetic, without being over-timorous. We don't help the United States make the right calls by telling Washington we can live happily with whatever public language it chooses to offer, and we'll follow it reflexively on whatever military adventures in which it chooses to embark. We should be saying to our friends in Washington, as I once heard Bill Clinton put it privately, although never so clearly publicly, the real choice for America is not to try to use our great and unprecedented military and economic power to try to stay top dog on the global block in perpetuity. The choice is to use our enormous economic and military might, and I remember these words vividly, to create a world in which we will be comfortable living when we're no longer top dog. I think it's that kind of approach that is what we want to be getting the Americans to say a little bit more publicly than they're prepared to at the moment. We don't help China make the right calls by failing to make clear just how much of its international reputation it's risking by manifestly overreaching on issues like the South China Sea. And I have to say that we don't help ourselves by appearing to jumpily overreact to security concerns associated with Chinese infrastructure investment in Australia, when we have ample power to react defensively, should God help us, it ever come to a wartime conflict situation, and when one would have to be living on another planet to believe that you can avoid cyber attack or cyber espionage by having only angels on your share register. The best recent articulation that I've seen as to how the United States-China relationship might most sensibly be managed comes from our own former Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. And in the paper which he wrote to the Harvard Kennedy School last year on the future of US-China relations under Xi Jinping, his analysis and his policy prescriptions are really very compelling. The realist dimension of his argument recognises that certain areas of disagreement are going to be intractable for the foreseeable future, with no easy solutions but requiring careful management. The constructive part of his thesis argues for serious collaborative tackling of a whole series of other difficult issues in a way that would see the United States accepting China as a much more equal player. Bilaterally, that might involve an investment treaty, a joint intelligence task force on terrorism, a cyber protocol, agreed measures for managing unplanned military incidents, and an agreed process for ratification of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Regionally, collaboration could involve a joint strategy for denuclearization and ultimate reunification of the Korean Peninsula, and working to further develop the East Asian summit process. And globally, the focus could be on further collaboration on climate change, which has been very productive so far, re-energising the G20, accepting the growing internationalisation of the renminbi, giving China a greater role in the Bretton Woods institutions, and working together on the reform of other key international institutions within the United Nations system. No United States presidential candidate is going to be heard accepting that the United States should ever become the world's number two. That's the reality. But it is possible, I think, to hope that over the years ahead, we'll hear less talk of dominance and get much more focus on policies that do reflect the reality that it is only through cooperation and collaboration, through finding our security with others rather than against them, that we can ensure that the 21st century will not, like the last, become a veil of tears. Australia's got a very big stake in that outcome, and I do think that we have a voice that can and should be heard in achieving it.
A taste of the debate we have to have quite clearly from Professor Hugh White from the ANU and Chancellor Gareth Evans of the ANU, also former ALP Foreign Minister. And I did notice this week that Jeff Raby, whom we have regularly, semi-regularly on our show, writing his regular column for the Fin Review, he did also say that behind the scenes there was a lot of very productive diplomacy underway and talks regularly between the US and China, which he thought did portend those very things that Gareth Evans was saying there. So we shall keep an eye on that and welcome you to join the debate. And my thanks to our executive producer, Kate McDonald, for editing that down.
Discover the best of RN on Facebook. Simply search for ABC RN.